Welcome to episode 17 of the Obesity Panacea podcast. On this episode, I talked to a Queen's PhD student and obesity researcher, Atif Kukaswadia. Now, Atif's done some very interesting work in the area of bullying and obesity, and so I think everyone's really going to enjoy this podcast, but I should mention that during our talk, we talked quite a bit about his master's work, which is actually still being peer-reviewed at the moment, so we didn't feel it was appropriate to leave that in the podcast, so I've edited that out. So the podcast itself jumps right into the conversation, but we still talk about a lot of interesting stuff related to bullying and obesity, and the way that obesity and physical activity are portrayed in the media. So I hope everyone still really enjoys it. As usual, you can come and leave a comment on our blog at blogs.plos.org. And in case anyone's wondering, Ian mentions a few, or Atif a few times mentions Ian, and that is his master supervisor, Ian Jansen, who is a well-known physical activity epidemiologist. So that's who he is referencing there. So enjoy the podcast. Here we go. Are obese kids more likely to be bullied, or has this never been looked at until you did your work?
Ian did a paper, I think it was in 2004, that looked at that cross-sectionally.
Oh, okay.
So what we were doing was we were continuing that study longitudinally to see if there's a temporal relationship between the two.
Okay.
And in his stuff, he found that there was a relationship between obesity and... He looked at verbal bullying, so like calling people names.
Yeah.
Physical bullying, so like punching, kicking... relational bullying, which is like excluding people from, from activities.
Yeah.
And verbal, physical, relational, and there was one other form of bullying that I forget right now.
Right, okay.
But he looked at all of those, and that was like part of his postdoc, I believe.
Oh, okay. So a little while ago. Okay,
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, it was like 2004. So.
Oh, okay. And, okay, you might be a good person to ask about this then. And I mentioned this at the boot camp. I asked maybe John Spence or Ari, I can't remember. But, I mean, there's kind of these two things that we're trying to do. On the one hand, we want people to be aware of obesity and take it seriously. And, you know, if kids are at high risk of obesity and metabolic mm-hmm. risk, we want their parents to realize that and sort of take it seriously and try and do something for them. But at the same time, there's this whole stigma around obesity and weight bias, all these really bad things that we don't want to promote.
Yeah.
How do you do one without the other? Do you have any thoughts on that?
So we thought a lot about that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
One of the big things that came out of my thesis is exactly that. You don't want to stigmatize
right.
people, and especially with bullying, you don't want to blame the victim.
Right.
Because the big problem that you run into is if you have bullying and obesity, you say, well, obese kids are more likely to be bullied. The message that you do not want to convey is that if only you weren't obese, you wouldn't be bullied. So
right.
you really want to avoid that. So
right.
the way we looked at it is it more in terms of how we look at like racial discrimination, like racism or
okay.
sexism or like, you know, making fun of kids with glasses, for example, anything like that.
Yeah.
Where you take a society level approach and you make the behavior unacceptable.
Okay.
So people won't be I like to think people won't be racist because they know it's not correct. And then bystander empowerment. So if somebody sees somebody being racist, they're more likely to step in and say, that's not cool, you shouldn't act like that.
Okay.
And if people know that the behavior is going to hurt, like especially in high school, if the behavior is going to hurt them socially,
yeah.
they're less likely to do the behavior.
So you make it like a social norm that bullying people, for whatever reason, is not cool, basically.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, you make it socially unacceptable for them to bully people.
Right.
And you have to really change perspectives for
yeah.
people, and you really have to like educate the school and change the school's opinion, but that's really probably the best way to do it. Because if somebody was, you know, being bullied because they were from a minority group, you wouldn't blame the person.
Right.
You would blame the aggressor, the person who's calling them names. It's the same thing with obesity. You'd have to blame the person who's insulting them because they're obese rather than the obese person themselves.
So then what, do you attack bullying, like, for each issue? Like, that we need to decide about bullying kids for... or kids who are obese, or do we need to, is it more just attacking bullying across the board? Like, what's the, you know, a targeted approach for each different situation, or is bullying is bad and just trying to stop bullying full stop?
Yeah, I would say try and stop bullying across the board. You wouldn't want to isolate one particular thing just because there's so many different aspects to bullying.
Right.
It's all very much like a power differential. It's one person trying to solidify their power over somebody else
okay.
through repeated bullying incidences.
Yeah.
So you know, somebody tries to show that I'm better than you, and they keep doing it repeatedly, repeatedly, repeatedly. And so you would want to try and stop that behavior from being normalized.
Okay.
And so you like, I don't know that you would necessarily target people who bully somebody because they're obese, as opposed to people who bully somebody because they're short, because they're tall. Like,
Right.
you just want to make all of that. You're going to tackle the whole thing, and then if you found that there was one that was really sticking out, then maybe there's something that has a different ideology.
Right.
So like, people picking on somebody who has a certain characteristic is different to people who pick on people because they have another characteristic. So that'd be the.
And do you know, and I don't know if you'll know about this, I'm gonna ask anyways, so kind of curious. Are there, you know, any interventions or programs or anything that have been successful in reducing bullying? Like, is it something that's, you know, we know how to fix it once we see it, or is that sort of a whole other problem that somebody else is dealing with?
I'm not familiar with that literature at all. Like, I don't know what's been done and
Right.
what works. I know that in theory, like what they should be doing, but I haven't got any evaluations of anti-bullying
Right.
interventions.
That's a very good master's thesis
Yeah.
response. That was good. That's fascinating. So then the other thing that you mentioned before was the picture of this woman on the Segway. So why don't you
Yeah.
describe this picture? Because it's interesting.
So this picture came out, I forget when, it's maybe like a couple of years ago. It was a lady on a Segway pushing like a child on like in a stroller.
Yeah.
And she's crossing the street on a Segway with a stroller. And this picture came out, and I've seen it in a lot of talks. It's showing, we're more sedentary.
Yeah.
We're not walking anywhere, we're not doing anything. Like, look how, and the idea was, look how lazy this person is.
Right, they can't be bothered to walk and push the stroller, they want to get a Segway and push this way.
Exactly. So about a week ago, this gadget site Gizmodo, they put the picture up when it first came out, like years ago, and then last week, they just like somebody had emailed them to say, there's something wrong with the picture. This picture isn't what you think it is. So they did an interview with the person. They found out what's going on, and it turns out that the lady who was on the Segway was actually a cancer survivor. And she had a prosthetic leg, which meant that she, and because of the complications with the prosthetic, she couldn't walk. So this lady was actually with her grandchild, and was going to buy groceries from the grocery store across the street. And so her and her grandchild went to buy groceries, and she was actually going back to make dinner for her family,
Right.
like for her son. I think it was her son or her daughter, like their family. So there's this whole other story to that picture that people didn't like weren't aware
Right,
of.
so she wasn't being lazy, she was like the opposite. She was like going out of her way to,
Yeah.
you know, be independent, and this was her way of doing it.
Exactly, and so she was talking. So they, and on the website, they were talking about the Segway, and because a lot of people viewed the Segway as just being this, like a motorized scooter, basically, with the same mentality of people who have the scooters.
Right.
And apparently, there's a lot of rehab people are pushing for it.
Really?
Yeah, because like with a scooter, you're not given that mobility. You can't move around as much. And the Segway is basically the same size as a person. It's a
Okay.
little bigger, but you can do a lot more on the two wheels than you could on the
Really?
four wheels.
I never even saw that.
Yeah, but I mean, it makes sense. You can get around. You can move around places and narrower spaces as well.
Yeah.
So a lot of people who are going through rehab, they find that it's a lot easier for them to get from point A to point B on a Segway, especially when it's short distances, than on a scooter.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So it was just an interesting article, especially since I know that a lot of people have used that picture.
Right.
It's just interesting to see that. Oh, wow! We completely missed the boat on what was going on, and we
Right.
just took it completely at face value.
Well, it's funny because have you seen the Obesity Society has these guidelines for like the media for when you're discussing obesity? And I know a lot of our earlier blog posts wouldn't meet these guidelines because of things like, you know, you shouldn't show a picture of, you know, of a body without a head on it, for example, things like that. And it kind of reminds me of one of the other boot campers on the way on the train when she was saying that, you know, that she'd heard that you know, a lot of obesity researchers should have weight bias, and when you get down to it and you see things like that, like it looks like a great picture to put in your presentation, and it kind of comes back to this whole bullying thing and, you know, weight bias versus, you know, promoting healthy behaviors, that you really have to really sort of be aware of these things, because it's very easy
Oh, yeah.
to be trying to do something good and really, really, you know, hurt somebody if you don't think through what you're doing, you know?
Yeah, well, for sure. Yeah, I know that the guidelines, I think, were written by Rebecca Paul at the Rudd Center.
Okay.
I think she's the one, at least on the journal Obesity.
Right,
Like, it's her, I think she basically written the guidelines.
yeah.
it's very much based around not using, like, not paint, like, not even just, it's not even like big things, it's just don't paint obese people as being like lazy, don't paint them as
Right.
being stupid, don't paint them as being unable to control themselves. Just, you know, talk about it, be upfront with it, but don't like further stigmatize these people by
Right.
in the way that you talk. I mean, and Arya mentioned that at the boot camp as well.
Right.
Like, it's not obese people, it's
Right.
people with obesity.
Yeah.
So
Which
it's
even that, sometimes I find it's almost, I find it harder with overweight because it's harder to say someone with overweight. And that I find is awkward in sentences, but sometimes it'll be like halfway through a sentence and I'll be like, want to say it right and realize that I should have thought of it two sentences before to start my sentence correctly. You know what I mean? That it's kind of confusing, but it's interesting because I know like my friends that work in, you know, disability research, for them it's second nature to say, you know, someone, you know, a child with autism as opposed to, you know, an autistic kid or a diabetic person. You know, it's sort of like basic, this is how you talk about these things. And it seems like it's sort of very, very slowly getting into the obesity realm. Like it seems very new to everyone that I know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's definitely changing. Like, there's been a big push for it more, I think, I find more recently,
Right.
just because people have realized that, you know, this is words are powerful. It is important. It is important to get these viewpoints across without hurting anybody. And it's interesting to see that just the push that people are giving it now as opposed
Yeah.
to before.
Which seems like a good thing, really. I mean, it
Oh,
seems like a
definitely.
very positive move. And so what do you think, like, and this is sort of similar to my question from before, but, like, some school boards, I think it's maybe in Georgia or some places now, they're weighing kids, and if they weigh more than, you know, the 95th percentile, and whatever the number is, for their height or for their age, then parents get a letter saying, hey, just so you know, your child is, you know, at risk of overweight or one of these things. Do you think those sort of programs are good or bad, or is it hard to say without, you know, knowing exactly what they're doing?
It's hard to say without knowing what the program's doing, what the point of the program is.
Yeah.
I know that I have seen literature where parents will not see their kids as being overweight or obese.
Right.
Like, they just don't see it.
Yeah.
My kid's big. No, it's a big kid. My brother was big. Like, it's not.
Right,
They
right.
don't necessarily view their kid as being anything different to what they would have expected them to be.
Right.
The problem you run into is, you know, how much of it is up to the parent. And I feel like, you know, for some
Right.
parents, it'd be more of a slap in the face. If the parent's doing everything they can and the
Right.
kid is overweight, and then you tell them, oh, by the way, your kid is overweight, and they're like, yeah, I know that. I'm doing everything I can. What more do you expect? It's a slippery slope when you get down to
Right.
that.
Well, and this kind of, it's like that issue of, that pops up every once in a while, you know, should children be taken away from their parents if they're, you know, if they have obesity? And then it becomes this whole issue of, you know, well, what are the parents doing? And I've heard people say, well, you know, if the parents aren't doing sort of the gold standard and doing what they can, then maybe, yes, you know, you would look at other issues and sort of, you know, like you would in any case, I guess. I don't really, you know these things, but by itself, you know, obesity shouldn't be a criteria for taking kids away from their parents. But it's interesting because then people always come into the whole debate of, well, you know, it's personal choice and all these things, but also then, what is the gold standard? Like, it sort of suggests that we have some sort of perfect treatment program that parents can put their kids in, and really, I mean, that doesn't exist. You know what I mean? Like, even if we had that situation, there's still no guarantee that they would not be, you know, overweight or obese at the end of the program. Yeah.
Honestly, we don't know. I mean, as researchers, we're still uncovering all of the different things. But every time, it's like a ball of yarn. Every time we find one thread, we follow that thread to the end. We've untangled, like, there's like eight other knots that we've come across the
Right.
way. And one thing that came out again out of the boot camp was that there's just so many different things. Like, you know, the research that you're doing, that I was doing, that about three or four other people, it's all very like epidemiologic sort of,
Right, right.
like, you know, social epis, that sort
Yeah,
of
yeah.
research. And we're all interested in obesity, but we're all in widely disparate fields.
Yes,
You
yeah.
know, you have people who are interested in bike lanes, for example, and that's not even closely related to what you do, not closely related to what
Right.
I do, but it's all part of the obesity problem,
Yeah.
obesity epidemic. And it's interesting because we really have no idea. I mean, that even if we could, I mean, we don't have a program, like you said, we don't have anything
Right.
that we know is going to be a surefire fix for the obesity epidemic, so.
Well, it's funny because it seems like the one thing that does work is, you know, when John Spence showed, you know, the EPOD study and the Shape Up Somerville, these programs where they basically, you know, re-engineer an entire town to be active living and healthy diets and all these perfect things, and oh, what do you know, people get healthier, but it seems like if you examine any of those components on their own in efficacy trial, it doesn't really do much.
No.
And then we come up with this, you know, conclusion that, oh, well, you know, better gym class isn't the answer. And it's not surprising that gym class on its own wouldn't be the answer, but when you're doing better gym class and community programs and healthier diets and education, all these things, you know, the entire community comes around it, it would, but then it's so bloody expensive. Like, I don't know how, you know what I mean? It's going to be tough to ever actually do that for the entire country.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the smaller the community, the easier it is to get everyone to buy in as well.
Right, that makes sense.
And that's, I mean, that's the big problem that you run into. I mean, that's why that, I forget the name of it, but was it the Scandinavian?
Oh, the, the Finnish one, yeah. The Krellis project.
Krellis. Like, with that one, the whole reason why it worked is because the citizens came to the council and said, this isn't, like, we need to fix this, you know, we're willing to do whatever it takes to make it work. And because they had that faith and that belief that they wanted it to work, it worked. And it's hugely, hugely successful. They've tried to recreate it in other places, and it's never worked since.
Right.
And so I think that it's the hardest part is just getting the buy-in from the public and getting people to want to fix it.
And I mean, in a place like Toronto, where you've got 6 million people, like, what is it, the most multi-ethnic city in the world, or just about, you know, all these different cultures and backgrounds, you think it's going to be really tough to get, I mean, 6 million people, that's huge, to get them to buy in, that's...
And, I mean, and you touched on the other thing as well, is that it's, when you have a very, very homogeneous, like, culturally homogeneous population, they have a similar value structure.
Right.
And that's where a lot of the problems come in, because people will value certain things differently.
Right. Like,
Western culture, it's very individualistic. Eastern cultures are very family-oriented, they're very group-oriented.
Right.
A friend of mine was telling me a story, just to digress, but she was working for a company that had a project in Canada and a project in Japan.
Okay.
And so they went to Japan and they did this, you know, they were working with people there, and in customs, you know, somebody does a good job in a meeting, you're just going to say, well, you know, Travis, you did a great job on that, well done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the norm. This guy did that in Japan, he said to the guy, you know, one of the guys, oh, you did a really good job. That was actually shameful. It's... Before somebody in a team environment to be singled out as doing
a bad thing, you don't want that.
Yeah, you're stigmatized because you're viewed as being not a team player, even though you're doing a good job.
Right.
So stuff like that is stuff that especially when you're talking about cities like Toronto, even Ottawa, Montreal, anywhere in Canada, you're looking at very, very diverse people, very diverse cultures. Languages is the other thing.
Right.
How do you translate something from English even into French?
Right.
Without keeping the spirit of the message, without changing the message itself.
Well, I know even cause I know projects that I haven't been involved with, but that I have friends have been involved with, that have been done in Vancouver, and they've had problems because, you know, they want kids to come into community centers or whatever, so they're trying to give out pamphlets, and it's a matter of, well, how many languages do you translate this into? What are the, like, top five languages?
Yeah.
How do we find people to translate? And suddenly you have this really simple program that should be really cheap, and it becomes very expensive because it's just really hard to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, and Ian brought this up at the boot camp, is that it gets, like, impossible to make guidelines, because obviously, I mean, for a Caucasian population, you're making BMI suggestions that, you know, 30 is obese, and or type 1 obese, and then if you have, you know, Southeast Asian populations, it's, what, 25 or 27, mm-hmm. and then, you know, African American populations, it's something different, and then in Canada, you know, people are intermarrying, and then if, you know, if you're two-thirds... Something like two-thirds wouldn't work as a ratio. You know what I mean? You're one-eighth Caucasian, and you know what I mean? It becomes this weird mix that... Not a weird mix, but you know what I mean? In terms of guidelines, well, what's the appropriate guideline?
Yeah.
It's like... Yeah, it's...
And then that leads to the whole other question of, does BMI even matter? Because there's some people who turn around... who after all of that argument, you find out you have these perfect guidelines, like, okay, you know, here's an equation based on the... whatever percentage you are, African American versus Caucasian versus Asian versus whatever, this is what your BMI, if your BMI is this is overweight. And then some people turn around and say, well, BMI is not a good measure anyway, and then you're back to the drawing board.
Right. Well, I mean, like, you know, I mean, I worked with Bob Ross, right? So I'm very much a waist circumference, visceral guy. But even then, you know, like, given amount of visceral fat for someone who's Southeast Asian, you know, they can have very little and still have, you know, much higher risk than Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
And see, this is the kind of thing that, the boot camp. By the end, I started to feel optimistic again. But at the beginning, or like midway through the week, I was talking with Aria.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of getting, not depressed, but just sort of deflated. It was like, everything we do, I can come up with like 8 reasons why it's not going to work.
Yeah.
And then by the end of the week, it almost seemed kind of intentional that then it was like, okay, here are things that are working. And here is, oh, like medical models that do work for the treatment of obesity. Yeah. And here are community programs that do work and are seeing really good benefits. But yeah, it seems it's not a simple problem to deal with, that's for sure.
Not at all. I think that's the trouble that we're going to run into as we go through our careers. It's just figuring out what works, what other things we need to draw on. And that's one thing I think I really appreciate from like my background in the EPI program at Queen's is that it's a very multidisciplinary faculty. It's a very multidisciplinary program. And the one great thing that came out of the bootcamp was that we all got to network and talk with each other and meet people who have widely disparate views, widely disparate opinions and experiences. Mm-hmm. But we need to draw on all of that in order to make an effective intervention at the end of it, something that we can actually use and implement to say this is what we're going to do, this is what will work, hopefully, and then go from there.
That was episode 17 of the Obesity Panacea podcast, my chat with Atif Kukaswadia. I hope everybody enjoyed it. Just a reminder that, as always, we'd love to hear your comments and feedback, so you can do that at blogs.plos.org/obesitypanacea, or you can just Google Obesity Panacea and you should find us. And so thanks again for listening, and we will see you next time.